Sven, thanks very much indeed. Just before we throw it wide open for questions, just a couple of things I wanted to throw at you. I mean, there's a very famous, and this maybe raises a point or maybe doesn't, I don't know, a famous example, I wish I could remember the philosopher's name, a philosopher who spent a year at Holborn Underground in London as a kind of philosophical and social experiment, and then wrote about the experience afterwards. And one of the most striking episodes in that was one day he was standing down on the platform and a guy keeled over with a heart attack or a stroke or something and was lying on the platform. And he was down helping to resuscitate this guy and prepare him for the paramedics. And four different people came along, tapped him on the shoulder because he was wearing his uniform and said, is this the train for Edgware Road or is this the train for Chancery Lane or whatever. None of them appeared to notice the guy on the ground at all, which is, I suppose, a parallel to what you were dealing with there with the trick with the door. Now, is it not so much a function of our visual perception as the way we task ourselves in life, that we are, if we are bound for a train or we're bound for a specific task or giving directions, we're not primed to see? It's nothing to do with our capacity to see.
Absolutely. And this, I mean, it's kind of a point that Chris was touching on. You know, our experience is all about, is really only just a little bit about this front end, this perceptual end to the system. You know, it is about context, expectation. Task has a huge influence. You know, so if you send someone in to a kitchen to make a cup of tea or a cup of or a sandwich, they're going to look at fundamentally different things. They're going to expect different things in that room, and they're going to remember different things about that room. So absolutely, it is totally to do with the task. You know, task has a very strong influence on what we pay attention to in the world. So it absolutely is. Yeah.
I used to present a program on Radio Scotland called The Usual Suspects, which was obviously based on the Casablanca line rather than the movie. But the movie features a lineup. And one of the things that really struck me about that was that the definition of eyewitness that you used at the beginning was inevitably a legal one. Mm. Doesn't this all rather blow eyewitness testimony completely out of the water?
Yes. It's deeply worrying. it does. I mean, you know, we just don't have this... It's one of the big problems of being human, in that we have a very strong sense of vision. We're maybe primarily visual in the way that we think about ourselves, and yet... it's not a good sense. It's not a faithful sense in the way that people think it is. So I think I would not trust any eyewitness statement. You know, I would not trust... You can remember things. You can remember things, but what you remember is not visual detail. You remember more abstract concepts. You know, so you might extract things about positions or certain characteristics of individuals. Okay, so you might, for example... like, beards tend to be things that people can never remember whether they have or not. You know, that's a visual detail that just doesn't seem to be very relevant to our interaction with people, and so we don't remember it. Whereas you might remember something more about the mannerisms of a person or some, you know, they can be features that we extract, like some very identifiable hairstyle or something like that. But again, the details are not there. But people reconstruct those details. When you think about something, you know, we all have this idea that we can reconstruct a vivid mental image of some scene that we've been in before. And so we can create this illusion to ourselves that we're remembering a lot of visual detail. But when you actually try and test whether that's true or not, then it turns out not to be. So I think it does really blow, you know, there's this big difference between how well we think we can trust vision and how well we really can. So yeah, I mean, I would worry deeply about what I witness.
So, I mean, leaving aside the aesthetics, which I suppose is what we're mainly concerned with here, I mean, you think there are real world consequences for the kind of research you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, things like, you know, you hear of failures to see... I mean, there was the classic... The Potter's Bar rail disaster was about failing to see a red light. That was, you know, not because the light was not a salient signal, but because they weren't expecting it to be red. There was too much going on in the scene that they were having to pay attention to. It has, you know, it has big consequences. A lot of... you know, this sort of narrowing of attention to one particular thing and not being aware of other things around it is the primary cause of plane crashes, for example. I mean, that's not necessarily about vision, but it's about... Oh, no, there's a very good example of that. They tested this on pilots where they had one of these, you know, kind of change blinds displays, except all they did was they had people coming in to land, and they just, on the flight simulator, they just slowly moved a plane across the runway at 90 degrees. And I think 80% of the pilots just carried on and landed through the plane and hadn't noticed that it was there, because they're used to being told that the runway's clear and that's fine. So it can have fairly profound consequences on how we deal with life.
That's my holiday castle. can we open this up? Now, I'll take this side again if there are any questions over here. There's one right up here.
It was just really to ask about the distinction between, I guess, the physiological and the cultural determinants that have affected this, and whether or not a lot of the issues to do with the attention that the way in which we apply attention are actually learned through a mediated culture that we inhabit, and whether or not there's been any comparative studies between people who inhabit a mediated culture and those that don't.
I would completely agree with you. I mean, I think that given what we've seen about, you know, the importance of social interactions and things like that for the deployment of attention and our expectations, which of course are culturally driven, then I would think that cultures have a huge influence on our experience of the world around us and what we do and don't see. We different cultures will have a whole different set of expectations that they bring to walking into a new environment, for example, about what's going to be there. And these have such a profound effect on our experience. I'm sure that's the case. I'm saying I'm sure that's the case because I don't know of any work that's actually tested that with these kinds of things, because this kind of understanding about, to a certain extent, you know, these things where we don't see changes, where we miss important things going on in the real world, these experiments in psychology are all very new. So people are still trying to understand the general principles rather than focusing in on some of the more interesting questions, perhaps. But maybe something that does touch on that is that you can see that there are big individual differences, and we saw that even in this room, about how people detect these changes. So sometimes there are people who are very good at it and sometimes there aren't. And if you show, for example, if you show football scenes to people who are very knowledgeable about football, they will spot the differences quite quickly compared to someone who doesn't know much about football. So these, you know, semi-cultural prior experiences certainly do have a big effect on our kind of awareness of what's in front of us, yeah.
My question's about compensating. Because I have very poor vision, and I know it, and I also know that I'm very bad at paying attention to visual signifiers. My husband's a painter, and I'll go, oh, that's a nice new painting on the wall, and he'll say, well, that's been there for a year and a half. It's not very good for relations. But I'm wondering about the ways in which we compensate by distracting. So when I drive, I notice I'm a better driver if I turn the radio on and pay attention to what's on the radio, and somehow or other that seems to enable me to scan peripheral vision better and pay attention to what I'm doing on the road. If I don't put the radio on, I start thinking and focusing on narrow things, and I'm a really bad driver. So is there research that sort of thinks about the way in which one sense modulates another?
That's a very interesting example, because, you know, usually it's the case that when people do look at these kind of, you know, influence of sound on attention and things like that, you know, in the visual domain, then usually it's about how having extra things can make you more narrowly focused and distracted effectively. So things like, you know, talking on a mobile phone isn't necessarily a good idea. So your example is very interesting for yourself. But there has been work looking at how auditory signals influence, you know, where you look and things like that. So not really answering your question here, but what someone is speaking about has a profound effect on how you look at the world. So if you're showing someone I don't have an example, but if I was showing you a picture where there was a boy, a girl, a cake and a ball, if I start to say to you, you know, the boy is going to eat the, you will firstly be looking at the boy when I'm talking about the boy. And secondly, before I even get to what he's going to eat, you'll already be looking ready for that expectation of what's going to be eaten. It's more likely to be the cake than the ball. So we are often using language and expectation through language to influence how we or others look at the world. And because there is this kind of, you know, what you look at determines what gets through to attention to a large extent, then yeah, you know, the way that you pay attention to the world and become aware of the world is going to be heavily influenced by sound, by speech and that kind of thing. So I don't know, it may be that when you're driving without the radio on, maybe maybe some aspect of the driving task is kind of overrepresented in your sort of how to drive thing. So maybe you're paying too much attention to one narrow aspect of getting round a corner, for example, and not distributing your attention widely enough. And that, you know, that in itself can be a problem. That's not quite the same, but again, one thing that learner drivers do wrong is that they don't look around enough when they're driving. So learner drivers tend to be very focused in a small area right in front of the bonnet. And what they don't do is check, you know, they haven't learned yet that you need to distribute your attention quite widely when you're looking at the world. And only with experience do people start to look at other lanes and mirrors and things like that. So you can see, you know, this kind of attentional narrowing, you know, in people, you know, according to their experience, for example, or in your case, maybe it's something that's causing you to be narrow, I don't know. Yeah.
It seems that the for the senses, discontinuity for audio is a heightened awareness rather than discontinuity for visual stimulus. If in the clip where the scenes are changing with the colours, with the jumper, and all the other different things, we're seeing that as a discontinuity relative to an auditory process. There is a change, and it's happening very clearly at a finite time. But we're not picking that up visually. If we had the audible stimulus that was changing over a period of time, we'd take much more notice of it. So I'm wondering, as an extension of your driving experience, that a conversation is a discontinuous process where the vowels and the consonants are changing, the pitch, the tone, the intonation. And that is perhaps keeping you more aware of your environment. But if you're traveling around, especially in America and Canada, if you're on a straight highway and it's 27 miles long, it disappears into the horizon, there's not very much changing. But if there was a flashing light every now and again that was part of your discontinuity process that only appeared every now and again, you might pay more attention to what's going on.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there is, so a couple of things to say that. Firstly, you can get breakthrough of, you know, if there's a particularly salient signal, like, you know, an explosion, a flash or something like that, then sure, that can capture your attention, kind of breakthrough whatever, you know, even quite often if you're kind of on quite a narrow focused task, you can see these things. Not always. You know, you can get flashes that you're well able to ignore and not look at. But in terms of the weird discontinuity in those pictures versus the kind of continuity of speech, movies are quite interesting in that way because we perceive movies in a very continuous way. And we don't, you know, although we are faced with these abrupt, we're faced with abrupt changes whenever there's a change in point of view in a movie. Yet we take that disrupted signal and the impression that we have of it as something quite continuous. And typically, we're not aware of a lot of the editorial cuts that go on in movies. And there's been some work looking at how well people can spot when cuts between angles happen. And people miss maybe 50 to 70% of these cuts, even when they're trying to see them. So somehow we are taking, again, in vision there, we are taking a discontinuous signal and interpreting it as something continuous. So I don't think that it's I mean, it is different, but I don't think it's quite as different as maybe you were putting there. Does that in any way?
No, I'm just thinking that back to the synthesis of this piano tone, for example, it's the onset of the sound that's most important for our ability to recognize what you're doing. Whereas clearly, if you're changing somebody's jumper for a different color, that's a new onset stimulus for our eyes, but we are unable to.
Yep. So onsets. If they are not timed to occur with a disruption, like a cut or a flicker or an eye movement, then you do see them, and you see them very obviously. But onsets don't actually happen, in a way, onsets don't happen that much in vision, you know, because most of the world around us is already there. And the only onset, if you like, is when you look at it, but it's not changed. So I guess onsets are much less of a prominent feature in looking around the world than they are in listening to things, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Absolutely.
I was just interested in the relationship between memory and vision, and I was wondering if it's as much to do with the inconsistency of memory as it is the inconsistency of vision. And then I was also wondering whether you tried these experiments with people with so-called photographic memories.
Two very good questions. One of the current things that people are debating at the moment is whether really, you know, this is some of what people have been studying is more about what people remember than what people perceive. And that's a very good question, because the way that often these are tested is you ask afterwards what you remember. And you make inferences about what that means for the kind of moment-to-moment perception. But it might just be that the information... So you could even argue that that picture in the brain that I said wasn't there, it is there, you just don't know how to access it with your memory. And that's a debate that's happening at the moment. So I don't have an answer, and there isn't an answer to that yet, but it's a very important question to ask. To what extent when you... This is one of the problems of testing people on these kinds of things is, how do you test it? You know, and you can make these explicit tests of what people remember. You can also try and get some implicit measures, like is there something behaviorally that changes, even when people don't detect that change? Is there something like a preference for selecting a part of the... So they did an experiment where they asked people whether they saw a change, and people said no. But then they asked people to select one of the four quadrants, one of the four corners of the scene, as to where the change most likely would have occurred. And people were quite good at selecting that. So there is this difference between what people recall and think about and remember about vision and maybe what's going on under the surface. So people at some level were responding to the fact that there was change even though they couldn't tell you that they were doing that. And the other second point was good as well. What was it? Photographic memory. Very good question. Don't know the answer. Because again, you know, the idea from all this stuff that people are doing at the moment is that that shouldn't be possible. But clearly, there's evidence that it is. So we need to understand that, and we don't understand it at the moment. It's very much in its early days, this kind of work. So.
Hello there. I was just thinking about this just now, and I wonder if there's been any study into the difference between audio and visual recognition of repetition. Because I personally made some videos a while back of basically just normal things that are happening, like a guy going down a slide and then back up the stairs and so on, and people could watch. In the background, a car would go past every time, but no one would notice this until I turned the sound on when they'd hear the audio repetition. It's interesting how you can hear repetitive sounds a lot easier than seeing repetitive images. Has there been any study into this, or is it just anyone knowing?
Not that I know of. Do you know of anything like that, Chris? No, okay. Deflect the question if you don't know the answer. it's a very interesting point. And this whole interplay between sound and vision in these kinds of things, it hasn't been explored yet, and it is a very interesting question to ask. Sorry, not a better answer than that.
I was just wondering, how big a factor colour is. The very first example you gave with the white team and the black team, would you notice a gorilla if it was green and red?
If I'd told you to watch the black team, you would have noticed the gorilla. Because what it was in that case is you were... So yes is the answer. But, you know, basically I was telling you to ignore anything that wasn't white, and the gorilla wasn't white. If I told you to watch the black team, then you'd have been paying attention to black things and you would have been much more likely to see that. So yeah, you know, that might well be the case. And the fact that that gorilla was black, like the team that you were trying to ignore, is probably very important. Like you say, if it was a blue gorilla, we probably would have had a lot more people noticing it. So I think it's very important. Wider than that, how important colour is... I should say colour is probably quite important. You know, if you try and think about what you do accurately remember about things, colour is one of the things that sits up there as something quite prominent that people will encode and remember about something. So you might remember what colour someone was wearing more than you remember exactly what it was that they were wearing. So I think colour is important.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering, is the perception of misdirection species specific? Because I've done that ball throwing trick and I've fooled my niece, but I can't fool my dog.
Yeah, it is. If you try, I mean, okay, anyone with pets, you can try this. If you, pets just aren't very good. There are some that are, but generally, if you point at something, the animal will come and sniff your finger. Okay, it won't look up there faithfully like the rest of us do. Similarly, you know, if you look at something, they'll My cat is quite good at that one. If I look at something, the cat will look at it. But I don't know whether that's just me thinking it can. But yeah, no, animals tend not to be quite so strongly socially driven. So if you compare chimpanzees to people, you know, they're our closest relative. Very young children and chimpanzees are very similar in lots of their physical abilities. So if you test how well they can manipulate things, how, you know, and all that kind of thing, physically they're very, very similar. You know, a two-year-old child and a chimpanzee. But when you test their social skills and their social understanding of what people are trying to signal to them to do, then they're completely different. The humans can do it very well. The chimpanzees, they just lack this understanding. So it is very species specific. It's very very peculiar to humans.
Hi. Could you say something about the difference between, as it were, so if there's no pure seeing, and about language and how that relates? And so I don't mean sound, auditory, I do mean language, and how our attention is defined by, as it were, linguistics, really. So it's always filtered through a narrative.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And my own kind of thoughts about the way that we represent things that we remember about scenes is, you know, that it's probably a lot of it through kind of propositional language type coding, you know. So you remember when you recreate a scene, you know, to what extent are you recreating the visual image through language? I think it's very often the case probably that you are. So people are much better at remembering nameable objects than they are abstract shapes, you know. So you can really play around with those. And so I do think that language is hugely influential on our visual experience, which is kind of interesting in a way, because language is a very recent invention. So there must be more to it than that, but we seem to filter everything through language quite a lot, even though there must be bits of it that aren't, because we had vision for longer than we've had language.